Argue, argue, talk, 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 exaggerate, argue, pontificate, argue, just talk, shut talk, up. Talk, why won't you listen? Argue, why won't shut, you see? I know the story, just listen to me.
You're better off when you're spouting off. And now, here's your host, Karen Cataline.
And welcome to Spouting Off. If you are in the lower 48, in fact, if you are in Hawaii or Alaska or actually anywhere around the world, welcome to Spouting Off. I am pleased to be with you. And this is the beginning of spring. I can feel it. It's wonderful. I'm sneezing. And thereby, I know that spring is on its way. My body knows about spring before I do. There is so much to talk about, as there always is. And of all the things I could talk about, including the Mueller investigation, which is no more. It's dead, dead as a doornail. And we hope that, we absolutely hope that there will be a price to pay for false investigations. And there's just a lot in the news. But the other day, I went to a meeting, one of those meetings you go to of conservative Republican strategists. And something came into the meeting that I thought was great fodder for discussion. It's something that comes up all the time, but it rarely ends up in a talk show as a discussion issue. And before I get into it, I'm going to let you know that if you'd like to call me in this first half hour before our guest, which I'll be telling you about momentarily, you can call me at 888, that's 888-627-6008. So at this meeting, most of you know that I hail from Colorado. I'm a native of Colorado, but now I'm living in northern Colorado and even further parts north of that in Wyoming. And so I attended a meeting about the strategy because in Colorado, there is monopolistic Democrat rule for the moment. The Democrats own, thank God, let's hope it's not permanent, the Colorado House, the Colorado Senate, and the governor's mansion, which our current governor doesn't live in, but, you know, he could if he wanted to because he's governor. So there are a lot of recalls going on because never in probably the history of the Colorado legislature has there been such dramatic and frankly unconstitutional bills being run through the legislature and about to be signed by the quite progressive, and I would rather call it regressive, governor of the state of Colorado, Jared Polis. A lot of different groups are planning recalls, and they have a lot of different motives. They have a lot of different reasons for why they want to recall. The leftists are trying to shut down oil and gas in the state of Colorado. They, for a while, were talking about something called a safe injection site, which got postponed till next year because the outcry was so enormous. They want to lift a camping ban in Denver. That's through the Denver City Council, which we might also get to, which basically allows people, not just homeless people, but anyone to camp in public parks, defecate. And if you are not concerned about this, if you think this is compassion, I urge you to go watch online on YouTube a film called Seattle is Dying. In fact, that's worth an hour monologue by itself. Under the guise of compassion, which it very well is not, either for the people camping on the street who are mentally ill, drug addicted, or simply do not want to support themselves, or for the people who are living in neighborhoods and near parks and near anywhere in a city, it is an attack and a destruction of that city. And there is a concerted effort all around this country to allow people to camp in public areas and trash the city. Now, you know, I'm getting off on a tangent here because I'm telling you, there's just so much to be frustrated about. Remember when liberals, and I'm old enough to remember, when liberals were screaming and pontificating and lecturing the rest of us about littering? You could not. I mean, nobody, practically nobody, because they cracked down on it, would throw a piece of paper out a window today. That's littering. And there was a big push. And even some Democrats, you know, were at the head of this discussion about not littering and taking care of our Mother Earth, and let's not litter and let's pick up after ourselves and all that. Never mind that liberals, when they protest, they're always the filthiest and dirtiest and leave the biggest trash around. But now liberal policies are allowing criminals, drug addicts, homeless, and a whole host of other people, not just all those groups, to trash public areas in cities. Why would anybody support a policy like that? If you have thoughts, give me a call. I have some thoughts on that. And maybe I'll have time to tell you about it. It goes hand in hand. I'm going to do it right now. It goes hand in hand with the notion that you can have safe injection sites. You can have places where people can go to shoot up without being bothered. And the only thing a medical professional is going to do is administer Narcan if they overdose. That this somehow is helpful to the person. No, this is insanity. This is insanity. You don't help people by allowing them to break the laws and to infringe on other people's rights. I have looked at for a very long time the whole notion of what makes freedom and liberty possible. And I found a quote that I think is exceptionally important. And I said something close to it, my very own self. And it's this. It's a quote by Clarence Darrow, the famous attorney. And he says, "You can only protect your liberties in this world by protecting the other man's freedom. You can only be free if I am free." That goes to the whole question of freedom of expression. If you go around shutting down people that you disagree with, eventually you will be shut down too. But I'm going to go back to this meeting that I was telling you about. So at this meeting, there was a discussion of a recall of a person who voted against her own constituents in a very oil and gas producing area in northern Colorado. And people are fit to be tied. They want to get rid of her because she voted against their interests. Probably it's not going to make a difference because, as I mentioned, there's a monopoly of power among Democrats in Colorado. If you want to see what Democrat Nirvana looks like, just watch Colorado. Even if you're in Idaho, even if you're in Cincinnati, even if you're in Florida listening to me, if you want to know what Democrat Nirvana looks like, it's people defecating on the street. It's, quote, safe injection sites, which even Governor Moonbeam voted against, Governor Jerry Brown in California. And it is a level of permissiveness that jails law-abiding citizens. It's as if, and it is, law-abiding citizens are the bad guys and criminals are the good. And I've said this often, that in the leftist vernacular, criminals are victims and law-abiding citizens are criminals. And that is a twisted, sick way of looking at life. So if you don't protect the freedom of others, then your freedom is in danger. This is something liberals don't understand. Now, you may be wondering, well, freedom to defecate on the street? No. Freedom to live in self-government with other law-abiding citizens and to have our taxpayers duly and reasonably go for protecting laws that are on the books. That's how you protect freedom. Equal justice under the law, where everybody is subject to the same laws, even celebrities who tried to buy their kids' way into college, even FBI who tried to frame a duly elected president. They all need to be held accountable because that's the only way our freedom is safe. I keep digressing away from this story, don't I? Okay, so I'll get to it here. But it, you know, all of it is relevant and all of it is relative because it all fits together. So there was a person in this meeting who was unhappy about a pastor in this oil and gas producing area in Northern Colorado who called the legislator who's being recalled a homosexual pervert. And this guy admonished him, not to his face, he wasn't present at the meeting, and lamented about the pastor, saying, well, that pastor just gave our opposition an extra 5 points. Well, I decided to disagree because I think this is at the heart of a lot of the discussions and even debates that we have in right of center circles. And that is, do we want to be on the defensive in our message? And do we want to allow the left to define one person as speaking for the whole group? I contend that that pastor didn't even have to say that in order for the left to say that the recall of this legislator is all about the fact that she's a lesbian. But in fact, it is not. And if one person doesn't like that she's a lesbian, should that person, be he pastor or a law-abiding citizen, whatever, should he be shut down, shut up, drummed out of the public square? Well, guess what? Last time I checked, and I have to keep checking, it is not illegal to dislike people or even say something bad about them. It is not illegal to say that someone is a homosexual pervert. The left would have you believe that it is indeed illegal, and that person should be banned from speaking. Better yet, they should speak for all Republicans, because after all Republicans are radical Christians who think that gay people are homosexual perverts. Well, that pastor happens to be someone that I know personally, and his definition of a pervert, not that it matters, and he shouldn't have to defend himself, because guess what? He has a right to express his opinion. The funny thing is that pastor doesn't even have anything to do with this recall movement. He supports it. He volunteered to be in charge of it, but guess what? He's not in charge of it. He didn't even sign the petition. And yet, without any facts, the left will tell you that it's all about the fact that this legislator is gay. Well, that's what they want everyone to believe, that it is a personal vendetta against this person, against this legislator. The fact of the matter is, her votes have contributed to and will contribute to the destruction of the county that she happens to represent. There are families that depend on those oil and gas dollars, and they're already leaving the state. So if the left can change the subject, if the left can tell you that it isn't about that at all, and that it really is only about her being gay, well, that's all it ever is about to the left, whether there's facts to back it up or not. So here's what I think ought to be done. I think instead of running from people who may disagree with us, because I don't agree with this pastor, I really don't. But guess what? I don't think it's a sin, and that's a pun, for him to express his opinion. Let people take him to task for what he said and let him defend himself. I know him well. He's well able to do that. He can defend himself. And you know, as long as people don't start throwing punches, which I believe people do because they are shut down from expressing themselves, if people would understand the difference between words and actions, feelings and acting on those feelings, we'd have a less violent world. And I wrote that last week in one of my blog posts. The left wants to do the opposite. The left is always seeming to do the opposite. They want to make our words crimes. And they want to explain away and apologize for criminal behavior. So they want to let criminals out of prison so that they pose a greater threat to law-abiding citizens. And meanwhile, which we'll hear later with our guest, among other things, they're going about disarming law-abiding citizens who have never felt a greater need to protect themselves from criminals, because lawmakers are supporting the lawless. That's what it seems to be in Colorado. Lawmakers are supporting lawlessness. They believe in sanctuary cities, and that means defying federal law to protect illegal aliens who have committed a crime coming here without being adjudicated first and without coming here illegally. And yet, if you disagree with that, you're a racist, a xenophobe. And if you are a lawmaker and you support the harboring of illegal aliens because you don't think they should be deported, and we've talked endlessly about the fact that that's to get more Democrat votes, well, then you're just doing what's morally right. We have a huge number on the federal level of lawmakers, including Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others, who believe it's immoral to enforce our laws as they are written. Isn't that a violation of her oath? Well, of course it is. Of course it's a violation of her oath. Do people pay attention to that nowadays? There's a whole bunch of people that have been diseducated, uneducated, about the fact that that is the oath that people who are taking a seat in Congress take, and that is to protect and defend the laws of our Constitution. So we have some problems, ladies and gentlemen. We have some serious problems. But among the very first is for Republicans themselves to appreciate the threat that we are under in this country right now. We have avowed socialists who are advocating policies that are contrary to everything this country was founded upon. And I speak about it often because it's something I love to spout off about. And that is individual rights, individual freedom is what this country was founded upon. But in the example I gave you about the pastor who was speaking his mind, the left would have you believe that everybody marches in lockstep, somewhat like they do, and that all of us agree with one pastor. Instead of shying away from the pastor and hoping that he doesn't speak out, we ought to be able to use this as a teaching moment to say, guess what? We are not the same as leftists. We believe that if there's someone who expresses an opinion we don't necessarily agree with, we're not going to drum them out of the public square. We might challenge them. We might disagree avidly with them, but he doesn't represent every view in an entire movement. The idea that the left can paint everyone who opposes their policies as with the same broad brush, whether it's radical Christian, which is an unfair characterization, and I'm not even one, or a whole host of other evil, terrible labels. Number one, it's bigotry and it's not true. And number two, wasn't it the liberals who told us that you shouldn't have stereotypes, bigoted stereotypes? Well, now we see that the left, true to just about everything they've been doing in the last few years, has done an about-face, 180-degree shift in what they've been advocating. They're advocating bigoted stereotypes as long as you hate the right people, as long as you hate their enemies, as long as you hate white men, Christians, conservatives, Republicans, married women, a whole host of people that tend not to vote for them, patriotic people, veterans for the most part. As long as you hate those people, you can make as many bigoted stereotypes as you want. We don't care. So, you know, hypocrisy out the window, all the rest of it out the window. Here's another point along the same lines that happened just this week. On Facebook, a friend of mine said, you learn so much on Facebook. You learn what people are thinking, and oh my God, do you really want to know? Anyway, so a friend of mine posted an article about Colorado politics, and he said, unfortunately, Colorado's now a blue state, but our tactics haven't changed. Now, I know this friend. He and I vehemently disagree because, again, Republicans aren't afraid to disagree with one another. And I disagree totally because I think what he meant, I'll have to have a conversation with him again. Maybe I'll have him on the show. I think what he meant is that Republicans have to start moderating or modifying their message to include people who we have probably a larger number of independents, but people tend to mischaracterize what those independents or those unaffiliated voters are thinking. You can't know for sure unless you check it out. There's a lot of former Republicans in that group who got aggravated at Republicans. Why? Because they weren't acting like Republicans. They were going back on everything they said they believed in. So the question is, should Republicans modify their views in order to attract what is perceived to be a more moderate audience in a so-called blue state? Well, even a Democrat strategist that I've talked to believes that Colorado itself is probably right of center. They just had this giant takeover. I could get in the weeds about that, but I won't. So I contend, and I absolutely believe, that we have misread the middle, depending on what area they're in. We've misread the middle. We can never out-left leftists, nor should we try. What we have to do is know who we are and know what we stand for. Now, that doesn't preclude people disagreeing, but there are certain things on which we all seem to agree, at least conservatives. We believe in limited government. Now, some establishment guys don't vote that way, but that is a tenet of conservatism. Constrained, restrained government to afford the largest amount of freedom to the individual. That is a fundamental principle of conservatism. Lower taxes isn't always just about dollars and cents. It's about constrained and limited government. The bigger the money, the bigger the office, the bigger the government building, the bigger the government. So lower taxes, limited government, and constitutional principles are what we stand for. We are trying to attract an audience, some of whom have been de-educated to those very principles. Who needs to educate them? You guessed it. Us. We need to educate them. We need to fill in the blanks for them as to what America is all about. We need to step up to the plate and start reaching out to people who don't know why they're socialists. Why? Because they don't know what socialists and socialism even is. So it's our job to step up and to know what we stand for so we can persuade others, not cleave to what other people think. And ultimately, I'm going to tie all this in a nice little bow, at least I hope so. And that is to say, it is time for Republicans to stop playing defense. If ever there was a time when our country and our states are under attack from large, moneyed, well-funded leftists, hardcore leftists who don't like this country. Honestly, how could anybody who wants all havoc to break loose and for cities to look like Seattle and Detroit with criminals, drug addicts, and homeless people and mentally ill people going untreated, unhelped, and living in tents in public parks and on the street, defecating, urinating on the street? What person do you know that would love cities and love this country and allow that to happen? I ask you. We're dealing with people who do not care about this country. In fact, I would even say that they are nihilists. Either they want to destroy themselves, or they want to destroy America. Either way, their policies are phenomenally destructive. It's time to stop playing defense about that. So even if you have a pastor who calls someone a homosexual pervert, that doesn't mean you got to shut them down. It means you either take them on and discuss it with them, tell others he doesn't necessarily represent your views, but stop trying to shut them down. Free expression. Use it or lose it, I always say. And now's the time to use it. Use your brain, use your mind, use your voice. And that's what I try to do here on Spouting Off. Let me tell you about our guest coming up after the break. This is a personal friend of mine. I'm proud to call him friend. And he is a fascinating guy. Michael Sabbath, who is the author of The Good, the Bad, and the Difference, How to Talk with Children About Values. He's an attorney. He has done legal education for ethics programs, and he lectures throughout Colorado and nationally. He is also working, and we'll let him tell us, about his work on the Second Amendment and for hunters, but just the Second Amendment in general. And we will hear from Michael Sabbath on Spouting Off right after this break. Stay with us.
Do you have a secret that's been bothering you? Have you been wondering if what you're thinking or feeling is normal? Is there someone with whom you've needed to clear the air, but you haven't been able to find the right words? Sometimes you need an objective, second opinion to help you see your problem more clearly. Ask Aunt Emma, and she'll help you move past what's getting in your way. She's a former therapist who is wise and caring, but instead of therapy, she'll give you terrific advice. It's free to ask Aunt Emma and explain your need, problem, or question. If you both agree, you pay only $1.39 a minute. It's anonymous, it's confidential, and you'll be surprised at how effective it is. You can ask Aunt Emma by going to facebook.com/askauntemma. There, you'll find her phone number and extension number. That's facebook.com/askauntemma. Ask Aunt Emma today.
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? We are happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. It's a community of like-minded people who work together to pay for their medical costs. You choose your doctor and hospital. starting at $107 a month for a single, up to $449 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all kids. For more info, visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org.
Welcome back. This is Karen Cataline, and you're listening to Spouting Off here on BBS Radio Station 1. I am pleased to have with us as my guest a friend, an author, an attorney, a lecturer on ethics programs around the country, author of the book, The Good, the Bad, and the Difference, How to Talk with Children About Values, Michael Sabbath. Welcome to Spouting Off.
Hi, Karen. I don't know if I can spout off the way you can. Maybe I can just dribble a little or a few drops, but I'll do my best.
Yeah, and even though you reside in Colorado, you got that New York accent that I really enjoy. I love hearing that New York accent.
I've only been away from New York for 38 years, so... I haven't lost my accent.
I know. It's just delightful. It makes me want to give you a big warm hug.
Well, Michael, we'll arrange that.
Michael, tell us about this book you wrote, The Good, the Bad, and the Difference, How to Talk About Children About Values. What made you decide to write the book and tell us a little bit about it?
Well, thank you. Thanks for asking, Karen. I'm delighted to talk about it. It was birthed in a very unenviable way for those interested in or compelled to write a book or to learn from experience. I do not recommend what I went through. It came about by recovering from open heart surgery on December 21, 1989. Surgery was 7 in the morning, but who's counting? And in essence, I had an infected aortic heart valve. I can just imagine one of the surgeons saying, you know, something like, hey, Murray, this 1947 lawyer needs a new valve, you know, something like that. And but I came through it okay, and I was in the hospital, Porter Hospital in Denver, for about 6 weeks because of the infection on the heart. And it occurred through the winter when
sounds like you had a change of heart, and that's why you wrote the book. You had a change of heart.
I had a change of a valve. I don't know how
yes.
I opened the heart.
Yeah.
But what happened was I'm lying in bed for 6 weeks and pretty happy to have survived. I still had my MasterCard bills to pay, but other than that, I was pretty happy. My children were just were very young. My little boy was just 7 months old. I thought I might never see them again. And I was so impressed with the competence and the skill of the surgeons. I mean, I survived because of the combined skill and technology of many people and of a political economic system that allowed this kind of technology and mastery of medicine to thrive, and I was the beneficiary of that. And lying in bed for all those weeks, I thought, how do I pay this back? Kind of a cosmic debt, if you will. And I came up with the notion of writing a course, teaching a course to little children about ethics and moral reasoning and moral choices. And when I got out of the hospital, I did what lawyers are capable, or some lawyers are able to do. I started researching and writing and structuring and outlining. I went to my oldest daughter, Elise, was then just in first grade. And I approached her teacher, a wonderful woman, Sandy Pratt. I said, Sandy, what do you think of this idea? And Sandy said, I like it. Talk to the principal. And that was Jerry Kroll, who has passed away since. I said,
okay.
Jerry, what do you think? Yeah, go ahead.
If you don't mind, tell us a little more about the book itself. What
okay.
are some of the main premises of the book?
Okay. Okay.
I don't mean to, I mean, I love your story, but we won't get to anything else. And I was so engrossed in your story. Forgive me. Let's just talk. Let's do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. The book presents a structure, an architecture for moral reasoning and how to measure the morality of reasoning. It gives what I call the moral measures of seven ethical skills like competence and conscience and character. There's seven of them. I call them sailing the seven seas, the letter C, which at 2 in the morning one time was like, I thought was clever. pun, play on words, seven seas. And there are four ethical principles of justice, beneficence, autonomy, sanctity of life. And the premise is to be able to argue in an perhaps a Socratic method and discuss with little children what's good, bad, better, good, worse, and so forth. And how do you know something is good? I'll tell you a funny story. I think you'll enjoy it. It was in that first grade class, my first few weeks, and I asked the class, I asked the little ones, first graders, I said, how do you know if something's good? And they said, I never thought of that before. I said, start thinking. Then I asked them a question. I said, why be good? Why be good? And one little fellow raised his hand and he said, it just makes life go easier. And then another little guy piped up and said, yeah, and then your parents don't have to hire lawyers.
That's great. How do they know that they're being taught what's good?
Well, that is the critical question, isn't it? How do you know? How do you determine what's good and bad?
Right.
How do you separate wisdom from foolishness? And so I created these moral measures. And then I show parents how to have a conversation, what I call a culture of conversation. And I encourage parents, start early, start when they're four, start when they're five, talk to the kids. So many of the students over the years, this was about 25 years of going into classrooms almost every week. I asked the children, I asked them good questions. You know, what makes you proud? And I'll never forget this answer from a little fifth grader. She said, I feel proud when my mom or dad tells me that they respect my opinion. When my mom or dad asks, what do I think? And that is the golden nugget. That is the core. That's how you talk to kids. And the book is literally like depositions, the transcripts of actual conversations with the children.
You know, Michael,
funny. Yeah.
Are you willing to test out this theory? Because as I hear you talk, this is the most I've heard you. I've heard you talk about this book before, and I have it, and I've read parts of it. I should read the whole thing.
You really should. It
strikes me there's a lot of adults today that are morally confused as well as children, and many people, including myself, and it doesn't mean they have a monopoly on it. Liberals, leftists seem to have abandoned all right and wrong. So if you're willing, let's test out your premise here by something I was talking about before you came on. And I think you're familiar with this. Currently in Denver, there is a bill about to be voted on with, I guess, the city council, the right to rest, or the right to survive, as it's called.
Is that
where
that
they will
300 bill?
Yes, and they will, and this is happening all over the country. I want listeners outside of Colorado to know that this is, I try very hard not to talk about anything that is not going to either come to your state, in which I hope you have the votes to voted down, or that these are national things that are being funded by very big money donors. So just like the film, Seattle is dying, in Denver, they want to repeal the urban camping ban, and that allows people to live in tents and to live on public property all over the city of Denver, defecate, urinate. And there are people in Denver who think this is a good idea. So applying your book to how do you know, what would you tell them?
Well, there's a preliminary matter I think that should be addressed, and I'm not all that, you know, I tend not to be talking about the left and right and so forth. To me, in so many instances in my life, it's not productive. But there are many levels to answering your question, and you might start with a quote. Let's see if I can remember it. Thomas Paine, he said, to reason with a person whose opinion comes from the lack of reason is like administering medicine to the dead.
Wow.
This is a movement, and I share with you that I struggle every waking moment to see what I call the big picture. What's going on? How are things linked together that on the surface seem not to be linked?
Correct.
What is the unifying field? What is the physics, the string theory that puts everything together? This Proposition 300 or whatever it's called is systematic and symptomatic is the word, symptomatic of a larger movement, and that's the least of it. If you can abort children who are actually born, then letting somebody defile your city is relatively minor. Although,
correct.
So I look for the unifying themes now. You and I, or any of your listeners, can have a conversation about why such a proceeding, such a law, is wrong.
And well, that was the point in my asking, from an ideological standpoint. Why they're doing it is a whole nother conversation, and I agree with you. There are motives there that, and I fully agree, there are motives there that in which they are creating a movement for a reason. And I'll get
exactly
back to
correct.
That in shows to come. And I wish I had more time to talk to you about it. But from an ideal, let's just say that you had a 20-ish person who literally genuinely wanted to know what's wrong with that, lifting the urban camping ban.
Okay.
What would be
enough.
Wrong with that? You're just helping people who don't have enough money, whatever they're going to say. What would you say to them?
Well, I would say I would approach it. I would give thought to the discussion. I would try to respect, at least initially, the opinion of the person asking me the question, asking you the question. But I would ask focused questions. I'd say, such as, do you believe in such a thing as the public good? Do you believe that every act by somebody who purports to be good, a good intention, ends up being moral, ends up being beneficial? I would emphasize that good intentions are morally meaningless. Idealism is morally meaningless. Mm. In fact, I just wrote an article on an ethics of hunting where I have a quote, see if I can remember it, from the great psychoanalyst Carl Gustav Jung. And he said, essentially, every narcotic is dangerous, whether it be cocaine, alcohol, or idealism. Idealism is a narcotic, and it appeals to a certain kind of person. It appeals to a certain kind of person. So I would talk to that. I would question that so-called theoretical 20-year-old and say, do you believe in justice? Do you believe in respect for life? Do you believe that a person's actions can negatively affect other people? And I would go down a laundry list, and I would say, how does allowing hundreds, if not thousands, of people who are systematically, methodically destroying a city, inflicting perhaps disease, criminality, drug abuse, physical harm, assaults, crimes, and so on, how does that benefit? And I would ask a very pointed question, series of questions. I would ask them in a polarizing way. I would say, you have only one choice, yes or no. Does increasing the number of sick and diseased people in a city benefit the city, yes or no? Does
You're a good attorney, Michael.
Does the number of people that increase criminality help the city, yes or no?
Yes or no.
Are there ways to deal with these people without the greater harm to, and you just go down a list, yes or no. But the notion that the notion is that people just want to feel good, and feeling good is much easier than thinking, and feeling good is infinitely easier than taking moral action. And once
the
again,
reason that I like you so much, and you have such a soft spot in my heart, is because you're such a deep thinker, and you think about these questions. And I know that the book you wrote had to be a very difficult book to write. And I think it took you, how many years did it take you to write it? 15 years or more?
Not quite. It was a little bit more.
It took me 15 years to write my book.
It took about five years. I had so much material. I mean, while I was writing it, I was actually continuing to teach the course. And new material was coming in every week. These wonderful, wonderful little children. and I have learned, even youngsters, very young children, never underestimate the compassion, the wisdom, the decency of little children. And I mean little, 5, 6, 7, 8. And I try to teach, I don't know about being a deep thinker. I mean, there is a lot of bright people out there, and I wouldn't be presumptuous to include myself in that constellation. But I try to be at least intelligent. I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example of a case study, a case study, an example discussed in class, which is very relevant. It's relevant, actually, to this red flag law. It's relevant to what's going on in terms of school safety. And you tell me if you think that there are powerful lessons there. You may recall many years ago, could be as long ago as 15, 16 years, in the northern Colorado school district, there was this disgraceful behavior by a school administration, a school teacher, where a little girl, I think she was just 11 years old, 12 years old, an honor student, was thrown out of school because she accidentally brought her mother's lunchbox to school. When she opened the lunchbox during the lunch period, she saw it was her mother's lunchbox, and there was a butter knife in the lunchbox. And being a decent, honorable, moral, ethical kid, she went up to the teacher and said, Mrs. So-and-so, I just want you to know, I know we're not supposed to have knives, and I found I have my mother's lunchbox, and there's a butter knife in it. And this teacher, a product of no doubt a brilliant teacher education at college, and being a morally powerful, upstanding human being, immediately reported her to the principal, and the principal, being a product of a diseased system, suspended this little girl, suspended her. Okay, you can think about the merits and demerits of all of that. But here's another story, and the point of it is comparing two incidents, comparing. Then there was a student in the Denver school system, an elementary school student. My recollection is his name was Lorenzo Hernandez. It's close enough. And this was maybe a year or two afterwards. And he's playing around. It was a Denver school, maybe a little bit west of Broadway or so on. And he's playing around in a sandbox, and he finds what looks like a handgun. It was a stainless steel or nickel-plated pistol. And
yes,
he took that gun, and he went right to the principal, although so many kids were around him saying, keep it, take it, let's sell it, see if it works, see if it shoots. And he had the moral courage to resist all that.
Yes.
You see that in your mind's eye? And
yes.
He went to the principal, and he said, I found this gun. And the principal said, in essence, thank God, I'll take care of it. You are a wonderful man, young man. And the question is, and this is what matters, this is what I teach, this is what I wrote about in the book. The question is, if that little Lorenzo had found that pistol a week after that and went to the same school as that little butter knife girl, would he have turned in that gun? And the answer is, he certainly would not have done that. And as a consequence, people would have been shot or maybe killed. And when we see all these school shootings, I mean, over the decades, there's not so many, thank God, but you see a school shooting, you see an assault, you see so many horrors inflicted throughout the country, and you see people going to a school or whatever, and they bring the flowers and the teddy bears and the cards and the candles, and that, how could this happen? How could this happen? And the lesson I try to teach in this book, The Good, the Bad, and the Difference, is this is how it happens. This is
well,
how it
well,
happens.
I'm not. I think I would take issue with that. I'm not sure that there's is a direct cause and effect. And we're coming more to the end of the show when we could have a really good debate here. But I do think that your point about what some people do that affects other people's behavior is a brilliant one. That if that kid had been going to the same school, that kid, and they always call it unintended consequences, but I frankly think that they are more intended consequences. And that is that what you do with one person affects many, 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 many more people. Policies like that do have an effect. As far as whether a kid who finds a gun, I don't know if you're saying that that might be somehow responsible for school shootings. I don't know if that's what you're saying, but it sounded like it.
I do apologize if that was the impression. My point was, this is the point which I think is a credible deduction and inference. If the kid went to the same school and found that gun 1 week after the girl was suspended for accidentally having a butter knife, absolutely innocent, the question was, is it likely that little boy would have turned in the gun?
And I agree with you, absolutely not.
Yeah,
okay, that was just a secondary mention that had nothing to do with it. I think it's an excellent point. It's an excellent point. And it has the same connection to whether or not, believe it or not, leftists, and I do think it's important, there is a left in this country that is virulently trying to change this country as it was founded, that but when
there's no issue there, there's no
when
issue.
Put out the welcome mat for people to come and not work and get taken care of and live on the street and defecate on the street and rob people and live amongst mentally ill who are untreated, you become a magnet for people like that all over the country. And that has been true of Seattle, and it's been true in Vancouver with the safe injection sites. And so one law has great consequences.
I think the most intriguing question, the most intriguing issue, is why do the politicians do this? They know what we know. They know what you know. They are as educated as you, as I, as the folks that are at the Independence Institute. They know all this. The point is that they are, I think, so driven by ideology, so driven by the need for moral superiority. And no doubt there's a lot of money coming in, a lot of money.
Yes, by strategists, I would add, by strategists who have much more evil intentions. There are strategists who are actually trying to destroy cities in this country, and I don't think it would be very hard to make that jump. It's amazing. We get to the nubs of the issue just when we have to wrap it up. But I want to tell our listeners.
I appreciate you giving me the time.
Well, and this is why I love talking to you on and off the air. I want to tell our listeners that and this will be the first time they hear it, that I am taking the month of May off, and you will be my very first guest host on May 7th. So people will want to tune in. I don't know what you'll be talking about, but I know it's going to be great. How can people get a hold of you, your book, your work? We didn't even get to talk about guns and the red flag law, but I'll have you on as a guest again, Michael.
Well, thank you. I think that red flag law is very, very important, and it is the most malevolent and sinister legislation that I'm aware of. Very deadly. It's going to kill a lot of people. It's going to injure
terrible.
A lot of people.
Tell people how they can get a hold of your book, The Good, the Bad, the Difference, How to Talk with Children About Values.
Well, it's. I'm delighted to say it is on Amazon, I believe it's also in an e-book. It's supposed to be in an e-book. In addition to hardcover, I know there are a lot of used ones around there. That's how it's available. It's
great,
easily available.
And can people follow you? Are you on Twitter, Facebook, any of those that they can follow or connect with you?
That's a good question. I abandoned Twitter years ago. I didn't find it useful. I have a Facebook page, The Good, the Bad, and the Different, and
excellent.
I post occasionally. And I have a website called
Okay,
the
tell
Good,
us
the
real
Bad,
quick, because we're going to have to let you go. What is your website?
It's a kidsethicsbook.com, K-I-D-S.
Oh, excellent. That's a great place to go.
I've not been attentive to it in the last couple of weeks, but that is the website.
Okay. Kidsethicsbook.com, or just go to The Good, the Bad, and the Difference, How to Teach Children About
Values,
right. I just changed pages on my computer.
Yeah.
Thank you so much, Michael Sabbath, for joining us. We will have you on again, and you'll be guest hosting for me on May 7th.
Thank you for the opportunity to spout off. I hope my spouting was entertaining.
Oh, it always is, especially with that accent. This is Karen Cataline, and thank you to Doug, my producer, and to BBS Radio. And thank you to HW, a guy with the IQ greater than that of a small soap dish. And tune in next week when there's going to be a whole lot of, to spout off about next week here on Spouting Off.